Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse penultimate MLL podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Kyle Devitt, who I am sure knows the meaning of penultimate podcast. Kyle, what does that mean? How many podcasts do we have left this year?
Second to last.
Is there anything sweeter in the English language than the proper usage of the word penultimate?
Big events. Yeah. That's what The Wire did. They, like, killed someone before the last episode.
Spoiler alert!
Hey, I didn't say who it was.
True.
Just saying.
That was a very moving moment.
Yeah.
Anyhow, let's dive right in. We've got MLL Championship weekend on the horizon. We are recording this podcast on Wednesday. The coaches' call is in the books. Practices are underway on Friday. We've got, leading off Saturday, Denver versus Charlotte, and then the crescendo of semifinal Saturday is Chesapeake Bayhawks versus the Hamilton Nationals. Kyle, we've known who these teams were going to be for 3 weeks. We've known what the matchups were going to be for coming up on 2 weeks. We're going to dive in a not necessarily in as excruciating a style as you dove in to your preview columns, which will run on InsideLacrosse.com this week. However, you know, I myself spent last week in Ocean City and the weekend covering the Ocean City Lacrosse Classic, you know, kind of getting my sea legs back when it comes to the MLL, so I'm going to rely on you to kind of walk me through things a little bit as we get underway here. But just getting back up to speed, you know, I guess the first question I'm going to tee up for you is, what's your opinion of the two-week delay or the interim week between the end of the regular season and the playoffs and what it could potentially do in terms of affecting a team's momentum? And if you're, you know, Denver, who's the clear favorite and, you know, was very impressive in their final performance of the season, or if you're a team like Charlotte who's trying to pull an upset, what's your attitude towards what this layoff could mean for their chances?
I really think that the break is almost needed for everyone to recharge. It, you know, it's only 14-game season, but it is a long season, especially for the star players that, you know, make the All-Star game and, you know, play in every game and dress for every game. It's a long 14 games. There's a lot of guys getting beaten up, and, you know, the rest does them good. I don't think it's a disadvantage for any team more than another. If that makes any sense. I think certain guys getting rested, if you have veterans, like, it's kind of like built for the veterans to succeed. You know, the league wants its stars to, you know, do well. And I think that extra week gives them a better opportunity to do that.
And the other storyline, the other, I guess, way in which the MLL takes advantage of this extended break is by announcing all of their awards over the course of the season. By and large, the Denver Outlaws have swept them with today the announcement that Lee Zink is the Defensive Player of the Year, Jesse Schwartzman the Goalie of the Year. So far, we've learned that Kevin Crawley is the Offensive Player of the Year. And then you got to go back to last week to find out some of the other awards, you know, Staggs and Snyder, et cetera. What were your thoughts on the awards? Any significant surprises or snubs?
I was surprised that Crawley won Offensive Player of the Year. I thought he was earmarked for MVP. And I think that, you know, Bocklet not winning that puts Bocklet up in the MVP seat, which I didn't expect. I think people think that Bocklet, despite leading the league in scoring and points, is like a... You know, it's the same opinion people had or still have of Matt Poske, where, like, oh, he doesn't do much. He just scores goals. Like, really? That's your criticism? Like, oh, he scores goals. He's just, oh, that's all he does. He just does the most important thing in lacrosse. No big deal. It's fine.
Well, and it is an interesting paradigm when you compare it. We spent the preamble before I hit the record button of this podcast talking about soccer. And when you talk about the best soccer players in the world, they're the guys that score the goals, the Lionel Messis, the Wayne Rooneys. You know, Cristiano Ronaldo's a little bit of a different story given the fact that he plays on the flank, so same with Gareth Bale. But at the same time, you know, strikers, it's very easy to say that the striker is the best player in the world. You know, the number 9 can be the best. The number 10, you know, I don't know, like, it's just very bizarre to me how, you know, quarterback attackmen, do-it-all midfielders, those guys are so much more heavily valued than goal scorers. You know, I remember this being something that we talked about a lot in college across, specifically, you know, in that 2006 through 2009 window when Zach Greer and Max Kunzani were scoring tons of goals for Duke, and yet they were being overshadowed by Matanowski and Ned Crotty. You've obviously voiced your opinion. I understand it. I understand at least the argument and the way that people feel that way. I don't know if I necessarily agree with it. It's kind of a difficult decision for me to make.
Right. I just think with those two, I guess you could interchange them, but I feel like this puts Bocklet in the MVP spot, and that's unexpected. Because I think everyone else has that opinion that you're talking about. I think Crowley's much more of a creator, much more, I think, not much more important to his team, but important to his team in different ways than Bocklet is, you know? And I think that's evident in how the teams play, like both those teams play, that people think that you can plug some guy into Denver, but you need someone to initiate in Hamilton. You know, I think that the teams they play on changes how you look at that. But I, you know, the way it shook out, maybe not. You know, I think coaches and GMs are the ones that vote on these awards. And, you know, I think that they see the value that Bocklet has, and they see that he plays in a system, yes, but the system works and he scores his goals. So I would be shocked if someone else won it other than him. That hasn't been announced yet. It might be announced by the time you listen to this, but I think it's got to be him, or something weird's going on.
Well, yeah, I acknowledge that, except that it's not unprecedented that the same player has won Offensive Player of the Year and MVP. Would you be stunned if Crowley also won MVP?
Yes.
Really? How come?
Yes. Because doing that and then you're basically saying you put zero value on Bocklet's contributions if that happens. And it might be a close vote. Like they actually showed the voting. I looked at it real quick. And Bocklet had like 7 second place votes and 4 first place votes or something like that. It was really, really, really tight voting for Crowley to win that award. I would think that Bocklet would get it. He's on an undefeated team. How do you give that award to someone, an MVP award to someone not on the first undefeated team in the history of the league?
Particularly when the defending MVP is a member of that team, which is amazing that he finished third in scoring, I believe, on that team.
Right. Right. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, personally. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't make sense that happens, in the MLL. So, I still would be shocked, yes. I do believe it should have been flipped around. In my opinion, I really think that Bocklet should have won offensive and Crowley should have gotten MVP. But now that this has come out first, that Crowley's getting Offensive Player of the Year, I really think Bocklet has to get MVP. It doesn't really make a lot of sense for anyone else. But then I guess the next candidate would be Crowley. So it wouldn't shock me, but it wouldn't, you know, I don't know. It wouldn't make a lot of sense.
One of the other conversations I've heard, I've had a couple people that follow the MLL really closely say to me over the last week or so that Jesse Schwartzman was a legitimate MVP candidate. And I don't disagree with that in concept, but in application, what it seems to suggest to me is that there was a pretty significant gap, at least in these people's minds, between the season that Schwartzman had and the season that Brett Queener had. And I refuse to accept that, because when you look at them statistically and when you take into account the types of offenses and defense that they were playing behind, I didn't think that there was that big of a gap. What was your take what's your take on the comparison between the seasons that Schwartzman and Queener had?
I think looking at what they had, there are goalies that have had better seasons that have not even been close to being talked about MVPs. So if there are, you know, if that's the bar, and I don't think they're at the bar. I think there are plenty of other goalies in the history of the league that have had way better statistical seasons, except for Schwartzman's 14 wins, which I think is the one thing that separates him from everyone else. I think wins as a goalie in the MLL are a stat.
I disagree. I mean, they're really, like, there has never been a goalie that's finished over 60%, is there?
Yes, there has. I believe, I'm going to check.
Trevor in 2006, maybe?
I know there has. I believe Drew Adams did it one? No. What's his name? Burke did it one year.
Doc, yeah, okay. So in 2006, Doc and Tillman Johnson both finished over 60%.
Right. And in the expansion year.
Yeah, Levin and Gable finished at 50. Wow, holy crap.
Yeah.
Levin, Gable, and Cotrano finished at 59%, and Trevor finished at 58.6, and Garrity finished at 57.
Most recently, Jordan Burke finished at 61.5.
Okay.
In 2011.
Yeah, well, that was bad on me, because I actually think I tweeted about this a couple weeks ago, too. By the way, we're going to have to come back to this. Maybe this isn't the penultimate podcast, because we're obviously going to have to do a championship recap, and then we might have to do a little bit of an off-season look, given all the expansion talk that's going on. You know, one of the conversations being about how much can the league afford expansion in terms of the talent pool. And when you look at these goalie numbers in 2006, the expansion year, as you called it, pretty remarkable, speaks pretty poorly to the quality shooting and the quality offense that might have taken place that season. But that's a conversation for another day. The last thing I wanted to touch on as far as the awards were concerned, Kyle, was the Rookie of the Year voting. I think the thing that jumped out to me most was not that Rob Pinnell won, and certainly not that there was an incredibly talented pool of rookies this season. It was how low Eric Law was in the voting. I'm looking it up right now, but if memory serves, which I'm sure it won't because it just failed me moments ago, I think he finished, was it either 6th or 9th? Let's see.
Yeah, I think, again, that's kind of...
Yeah, Eric Law finished 9th with 2 third-place votes. Finished behind Mason Poley, Jesse Bernhardt, Scott Ratliff.
Finished behind
John Rennigan.
Mason Poley? Really?
Yeah.
Ugh. Disagree.
I think I would have voted for Eric Law first.
I don't think I would have voted for him first. In the column I just wrote, there I have this long kind of spiel about how I think, you know, Charlotte should attack or plan defensively for how to handle Denver's offense. And one of the things I said is, like, you know, I think also Law was really bad against the Bayhawks. And I think that people are probably remembering that if they're doing the voting. I mean, wow, 2 third place votes and that's it, huh? That's poor. I know a lot of people thought Schuss was going to win. I know Ohio did. The people in Ohio definitely thought Schuss was going to win. I probably personally, I would have picked Durkin, although he was a little spotty in a couple games against, like, top-tier guys. He still was really good against guys like Crotty. I think he was good. He was really good against Danowski until the last game where, you know, Charlotte didn't Charlotte put him away. I don't know. Dave Lawson with 2 first-place votes makes pretty much no sense to me. I think Rannigan had more of an impact than he did. Lawson had a couple great games at the end of the year, but wasn't a constant contributor. Ratliff getting votes is basically just Boston voting for itself. I think that's the only way, unless you can't vote for your own player. That makes no sense to me. But yeah, I mean, was Rob Pinnell going to get anything else? Like, I feel like he was earmarked from when he got drafted 2 years ago to be Rookie of the Year in his first season.
I mean, that's true, and we've already spent enough time talking about, you know, what I thought were the issues when it came to, you know, Rob's season so far, Rob's season in terms of the way that he was handled and how I think, you know, he'll kind of rebound and look towards success moving forward in his MLL career. And I'm not saying that he didn't deserve it. My point is that I think I liked the way the season that Eric Law had the best, and I liked what he brought to the role that he was put into, which is, you know, so it was very similar to the role that he played with Denver last year where, you know, he wasn't the quarterback and he wasn't the primary goal scorer, and when you put him alongside Mundorf, who's going to have the ball on his stick a lot, isn't necessarily, you know, as much of a passer as Alex Demopoulos was, you know, it's a tough spot to play, and how good you are in that position to me so often is the determining factor in how successful your offense is. I don't know, whatever. Water to the bridge.
I think, you know, one of the things, again, one of the stats I went over, not to keep going back to the column, because I won't be able to do this for the next matchup we go into because I haven't written it yet. But in his last 4 games, Eric Law had 6 goals, 1 two-pointer, and 4 assists. But out of all those points, he had 7 of those, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, like 14 points. He had like half of them in one game. And then in the other games, he had like, you know, the rest of his points. And in one of the games, he had zero. So I think people not necessarily figured him out, but I think, you know, when you game plan against Denver, you don't game plan against him necessarily, even though he's had, you know, he had a great, you know, obviously he hit his 9 first shots in the MLL for goals. He made a lot of headlines doing that, but I don't think he's the guy you game plan for when you have to worry about Mundorf and Bocklet. And obviously Mundorf didn't play in the last two games. So if you look at how you want to attack Denver defensively or game plan for them, I just don't think he's high on the, I think he's probably 5th on the list behind Sieverts and Snyder.
Well, and I think Sieverts and Snyder are probably the guys that you game, you know, depending on what you think is the most significant key to Denver's offense. It's either Bocklet or Sieverts and Snyder. I think those are the two approaches that you take toward how you align your defensive game plan. Are we going to try to prevent their ability to score from up top and suck our defense up? Or are we going to try to prevent their ability to score from the doorstep and suck our defense in? Playing Mundorf is all about just, you give everybody on your team, but you primarily give one guy an assignment and you challenge him and you say, this is about toughness, this is about heart, this is about being focused for 60 minutes, because the skill that Brandon Mundorf has is that he's going to try to run past you and take advantage of opportunities. You know, you support him, but it's the MLL. There's not going to be a ton of sliding. So that's not, to me, that's not really that that difficult of a decision to make defensively. It's much more, how are you going to approach these two, you know, one incredibly powerful alley dodger and a right-handed shooter on the run, and another guy who is a really good set shooter and really good at finding windows to get his shot off in, you know, 2 to 3 yard spaces, you know, and then even then you still have to figure out what you're going to do with Kiminer and Greer, who have had, in my opinion, also excellent seasons, you know, or Bocklet. And do you want to, are you ever going to leave him? Are you going to face guard him? Are you going to try to put a shorty on him? How are, you know, like, how are you going to try to utilize his space? Because to me, those are the two decisions that take you out of your entire defensive game plan. If you get beat doing things that you're trying to prevent them from doing, then that is where you find yourselves being, you know, more susceptible to problems. And I agree that, you know, Eric Law did not play well against Chesapeake. Rookies get blank from time to time. That's not, to me, a reason not to look at a kid that had 34 points in 9 games and say, wow, you know, he had a good season. And on the, you know, other, I guess, kind of side of that is, yeah, when, you know, you are the 3rd attackman and the 5th offensive option on the field, you're likely to get a short stick a good amount of time. You're almost always going to get the 3rd defenseman, depending on, you know, the quality defenseman of a team, et cetera, and where they want to, you know, bump up or whatever. But I don't know, man. I just thought he had a great year. That's all. That's all. I thought he deserved to finish better than that.
There's absolutely no way he should have finished last. I'll back you up on that 100%.
All right. So let's I mean, we've obviously spent a fair amount of time talking about you know, this Charlotte Denver matchup indirectly. Let's talk about it directly. Let's go head on. And since we were just talking about how you defend Denver, let's talk about it specifically from the point of view of how Charlotte should defend Denver. You know, and I've gotten the opportunity to see the Hounds play a few more times than I've seen other teams play. And I think that defensively, you know, they found their stride a little bit later in the season. You know, with the acquisition of Josh Hawkins, with Steve Dirks playing a little bit more, you know, certainly with Mason Pulley, offensive prowess becoming more a staple of what they do, you know, out of their own zone. You know, Kevin Drew, Casey Citadino, you know, they're a team that relies on 3 short sticks a little bit more, I think, than most, and probably, you know, anybody else in Championship Weekend. What do you want to see, you know, Brett Schmidt, Ryan Flanagan, Joe Sanoski, what do you want to see Charlotte do in order to be in a good position to defend this Denver team?
Well, it's funny that you actually asked that question. It's one of my second key to the game, and it's kind of more directly addressing Sieverts and Snyder versus Charlotte's kind of midfield defense. But, I mean, the matchups I think that are the most favorable are Schmidt on Mundorf, Sino on Bocklet, Flanagan on Sieverts, and Pulley/McCormick or Dirks on Snyder. And then you stick Drew on Law, Kevin Drew, and you let Josh Hawkins smash on Kiminer or Greer and just deny them the alley and the inside. And you kind of pack it in. In essence, you play a little bit more like the Nationals do than how Charlotte has done, because Charlotte does this weird thing where they pressure on the wing and then they slide upfield, which like sets you up for a drive from X or a spin from X. And I don't understand why they do it, but they do it all the time. I don't really think that all those matchups I just said work when Turi comes in, because he's so big. And like I said, Greer kind of demands a little more attention than most people. But I think Charlotte's, there's a lot of steadiness in the Charlotte defense, like level wise. Like this guy plays at this level, this guy plays at this level, both like speed and tempo wise. I think they play really well as a unit because of that. And they do have a nice slide package, except for when they pressure on the wing and slide upfield and then they get stroked. I just don't understand why they do that, but they do that. Sometimes it's kind of like they're trapped. They hope that guy doesn't make the right pass, but it's the MLL, so most of the time he makes that pass. I think that matchup, those matchups are the best for them, but I don't think necessarily that's what they will do. I think the weird part of that matchup that I just read out to you is Flanagan on Sieverts, kind of bumping up and taking that defensive role, because I think he's probably the most rangy out of all the defenders. And I think Schmidt is, you know, the stronger guy to handle Mundorf down low, kind of stuff the runs from GLE. And I think, you know, you put Sino on Bocklet just because you have to have a pull on Bocklet. I don't think shutting Bocklet off with a short stick works. I just don't. I don't think it'll work. Eventually you're going to have to slide. And even if you don't slide, like, who are you not sliding to? You're not sliding to Sievers. You're not sliding to Snyder. You're not sliding to Mundorf. That doesn't make any sense. You know, so I think that matchup is the best for them, but I don't know if they'll actually do it. And I don't think that, I don't know if they're going to put a short stick on Law, but I feel like I would if I was just watching what I've seen from them and putting in kind of the data that I've gathered in this piece and throughout watching the games leading up to this one.
Adam Gilman had a reputation when he came into the league as being a guy that let up 2-point goals, and I think that has stuck with him a little bit more so than it is reality. What do you think of Adam Gilman's current, I guess, kind of heat zone, where on the field and where in, you know, the 9 spots that you can shoot for, the 7 spots that you can shoot for, depending on how you define a goalie's head and abdomen as spots that you can shoot at. Where do you kind of see him being strongest right now, and where do you think, you know, Denver's strengths play into that?
Well, if you look at, let's just say we compare guys from the last 4 games, we look at Gittleman, and then we look at Schwartzman. The numbers for the last 4 games, believe it or not, are fairly similar. Obviously, Jesse has like 2-point more save percentage. He's got 56% save percentage. Gittleman has 54. They have the same goals against with 10.5. I feel like they're playing at good clips. I think this is, you know, Gittleman had kind of a rough time in a couple games that really affected his season stats. So I think people are probably looking at his season stats and being like, oh.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And not only that, but I also think that in specific games, he had quarters that really affected his game stats in a way that I don't think were like totally indicative of how he played in that game too. And there were a couple of games that stand out in my memory where he had outrageous fourth quarters and, you know, helped to secure wins for the Hounds that you probably wouldn't have necessarily seen unless you looked really closely at the box score or saw the game.
Right. And that's the thing with, that's also part of Charlotte's style that I hate, is that they, when they have leads, they will go into like this mode of slow everything down, grind it out. And I just don't think they're a grinding, they don't have the personnel to be a grinding team. And I think that they can't play that way. They need to play full tilt the whole time. They have the guys to do it on defense. They have the guys to do it on offense. I think the problem is, you know, they covet that lead and they get that 3-2 goal lead and they think it's like 5. You know what I mean? They treat it like it's 5 goals. So they're just like, oh yeah, they kind of go downshift to like third gear from 5th and skip 4th altogether. And I think teams actually, like, if you watch them play, like, you can see that happening. And you can pinpoint a moment to plan your kind of comeback, to manufacture goals against that style of play. And, you know, as, against the Wizards, I mean, the Wizards had several opportunities to win, you know, with, I believe it's like week 10, week 11, and Charlotte was lucky to get out of that game. You know, going back to Gittleman, I mean, not for nothing, he went 3-1 in the last four games. You know, so he's won three games out of the four that he needed to win to get his team to the playoffs, get him to 500. I mean, that's no slouch. You know, that's not bad. He's had 50, you know, he has 50 saves in four games. You know, that's double digits every game plus. You know, that's not easy. And I think people kind of, again, look at his yearly stat and they're like, oh, yeah, that's not good. Okay, whatever. You know, like he's under 50% and people just kind of discount him. And I just don't think that's right. I think he's a good goalie. You do have a good point of the 2-pointers allowed thing. He's let in six. And Denver has one of the most dangerous 2-point shooters in Sieverts, who also has 6 2-point goals by himself, and is tied for second in the league, with that number. That being said, there aren't that many other long bombers. No one else on Denver has more than 1 2-point goal.
That's surprising. I would have thought that Snyder would have had a couple.
Yeah, I think he has one. I'm almost positive. I'm going to double check that because I think I put that in the column and,
and you don't want to be wrong.
Yeah, I hate being wrong. So,
well, as you're checking that, let's move off the field a little bit just in the interest of time and the fact that, you know, this is an MLL podcast and I'm not sure how much taste people have for listening
one,
to
one
them.
1 2-point goal.
All right,
one,
there you go.
Okay.
Face-off situation. For as good as Denver has been and as bad as Charlotte has been, this is a little bit more of a question mark than you might expect, which you probably could fairly expect Denver to win upwards of 60 to maybe 70% of the draws in this game, with Jeff Snyder having played the last two games for the Hounds, and the likelihood apparently being that maybe not for Saturday, but likely if they win for Sunday, Denver will probably dress Steven Robards to spell Anthony Kelly and make sure that fatigue doesn't become a factor the way a lot of folks thought that it did in the championship game last season. What are your thoughts on you know, do you think Tim Fallon's going to dress for the Hounds? If so, do you think they're going to dress both of them? And then also, you know, what do you think Denver's approach is to the faceoff game?
I think that both of them dress, just because you need more than one guy against
both dress.
No, I think Fallon and Snyder dress for the Hounds, and I think probably Kelly with the week off and the recovery time is good enough for the first game. Maybe not the second game. If you go through the numbers towards the end of the season, you know, Kelly really tapered off, only 48% faceoff percentage in his last four games, compared to his season long of 55. Actually, Fallon and Snyder split time already. They have dressed them both, to end the end of the season, a little bit. And I mean, they both played together in the two games that Snyder played. So they dress both of them. It's not like it wouldn't be weird if they didn't. You know, I think it'd be weird.
It would be weird if just Snyder dressed.
I believe 100% that Jeff Snyder's going to dress.
I said it would be weird if just Snyder dressed.
Yeah, it'd be really weird because Fallon is really good. Like, I just, if you look at his, even look, his numbers speak volumes about not only like himself, but like the guys on his wings. I feel like he does a lot of the work on draws and doesn't get a lot of the credit. And also, if you look at Fallon against Kelly in the first game, he kind of got rolled, but he got 38%, but he still had 10 ground balls. You know, in the second game, you know, Denver and Charlotte's second game of the regular season, he had 16 ground balls by himself and won 58% of the draws. That's basically his best game of the year. I mean, Fallon had like 104 ground balls this year. I think that he's underrated and people don't think he's as good as he is.
That is the definition of underrated.
Right. But I also think that Snyder is overrated. So I think that.
He's not overrated if you properly rate the value of taking a running head start at the opposing team's goalie about 4 minutes into your penultimate game of the season and drawing a 2-minute penalty for it.
Yeah. I mean, he has 5 minutes of penalties in like two games, but that's Jeff Snyder. The only weird thing about his stats is that he doesn't have goals. Usually he's good for like one or two. He's, you know, they couldn't stand him in Denver when Reeser was coaching there because he would stay on with that first unit until he got a touch. And if he thought he could take his guy and the guy he was against was a faceoff guy, he would just go every time. And it drove everyone on the team insane. But I think Jeff Snyder's a good player. It's just, he's had two games. Is he ready for championship weekend? He has the pedigree. You know, he's got a gold medal. I don't know. I just think that they have to dress them both. But again, Kelly's stats really took a hit towards the end of the season. How much has he recovered? You know, he's got to rely more on his wingmen than Fallon or Snyder do. So I think that's a big part of the game plan for the draws and guys on the wing, in this game.
And then let's, you know, kind of close this out with, how Charlotte is going to score goals against Denver. You know, it's interesting to compare the, you know, season's totals of both of these offenses where, you know, I mean, to the one degree, Denver scored more goals because they were a better team. They were a historically good team. That's why they're the one seed. That's why Charlotte's the four seed, etc. That being said, you know, I find it interesting how much, and maybe this is the reason that Denver is the one seed and Charlotte's the four seed, how much, you know, more production Denver got out of their, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh offensive options than Charlotte did. And when you look at the fact that, you know, Jake Chapuka and Matt White are around 10 points, and Mason Pulley is right there too, and that's what I was talking about. You know, it's interesting. I think he's one of the few long sticks, offensive-oriented long sticks, whose offensive threat is so well recognized that it actually does affect the way opposing offenses attack their defense, or at least it might, you know, might be starting to. I got the sense the last couple Charlotte games that I saw that, you know, teams were trying to avoid giving up transition opportunities to the Hounds in ways that they don't worry about with other teams. All of that being said, I think that, you know, when you saw Jake Trepiuka in their last two games, you know, and even Matt White, who I think was a little bit more, you know, maybe consistent throughout his nine games in the regular season, you started to see a couple guys emerge as, you know, options that it's not just Matt Tanowski, Ryan Young, Pete Poyon kind of shouldering the majority of the offensive burden, particularly going to the goal, creating offense, and then Lusby and Sawyer kind of finding their opportunities there within. You know, it was other guys who, you know, it kind of seemed like White was available for garbage goals in like an incredibly high rate, and Trepiuka was getting his dodging, and, you know, kind of, he's real good dodge and stopper, so he can dodge, stop, and get an 8-yard shot out, and, you know, there's a lot of value in that too, and I think that, you know, maybe the whole point of this is maybe when you look at the Hounds in total over the course of the season, it's not as valuable to look at them offensively that way as it is to focus on, you know, the recent sample size. This is obviously something that was a part of your exercise. Do you agree with that assessment? Do you feel like that offensively they're a better team over the last three games than they were over their first 9 to 10 to 11 games?
Yeah, I think that just in general, you know, the guys you just listed off are all rookies. Sawyer, Trepiuka, White, even you know, Haas has gotten in towards the end. I think that's a big deal. And also, those guys getting points is a big deal when you consider that the ball carriers on this team are Poyon and Danowski. And now Ryan Young, you know, attacking from behind the net when Danowski's not there. You know, I think between those three guys, that's, you know, they've scored a large majority of Charlotte's points. And I think in order for Charlotte to win, and again, I hate going back and ripping from my own column, parroting myself, but in order for Charlotte to win, Sawyer, Trepiuka, and White have to combine for 10 goals. That's my theory. That's my stance on what they need to do. And I think out of those, you know, three guys I listed, I think Trepiuka is the most likely to get a hat trick. You know, Sawyer and White play pretty well together. Sawyer plays really well with Lusby. They play a nice little two-man game, but it hasn't really paid dividends the last couple games. I think Lusby is almost – I think Lusby is guardable with a short stick, no question. I think you just put a short stick on Lesby. I don't know why you're worried about him. Just put a short stick on him. You're good. I just don't think he's shown the ability to dodge and go to cage to be a threat. And I think that allows you to pull Poyon and either Sawyer or Chipuka, depending on who they run out of the box. Now, the first time Denver played Charlotte, they ran Danowski out of the box, and that's when Denver had Eric Martin on the team, and Danowski torched him for two goals out of the box, running straight at the net and scoring. I think, obviously, that's not going to happen again because Eric Martin is no longer with the team, and I think also Denver will be prepared for that if Charlotte tries to do that. Charlotte didn't really do that in the second game, but Danowski still ripped them apart in the second game and had two goals and two assists, but actually controlled a lot of the ball, played really well. I mean, it wasn't his five goal, one assist performance in the first game against them, but it was still really good. And actually going into this game, Danowski's probably the hottest player on the Hounds. So if you can stop him from scoring goals, I think you have to sacrifice him being a distributor, and let him do that. And if you do that, then those three guys are the guys that need to score, you know, Sawyer, Chipuka, and White. And, I think they need to score big, one or two goals apiece, no doubt.
The, you know, one of the things about Poyon and Danowski's game, both in terms of their production and also in terms of the way that you have to defend them, they've combined for 11 two-pointers on the season. And, you know, they're gunners. That's not, I think, you know, something that's going to turn a lot of heads. They've combined to take 207 shots. But you have to take a lot of shots when you're taking twos, and, you know, a lot of times those shots are going to come right back to your team, and they aren't going to necessarily hurt you in a dramatic way. Do you feel like those two guys need to hit a bomb or two in order to keep this game close? And also, do you feel like Jesse Schwartzman's liable to give one up?
Well, Schwartzman's only given up three all year, so I don't think that's something that Charlotte's going to game plan for. I'm sure that Poyon will take a couple. Whether or not one goes in, I mean, that's definitely going to be a key to the game. If he can get his hands free, or if Bocklet can tie him up, or if they put McGill on him.
Quick sidebar to this.
Yep.
What percentage of 2-point goals that are scored on a year-to-year basis would you say are lucky? And by lucky, I mean screens, deflections, or the goalie wasn't ready for it.
20%.
So, yeah, I mean, that's just a crazy thing to think about when it comes to such a valuable goal. Do you feel like, do you wish 2-point goals were lucky a lower percentage of the time? Just do you think it would make, like, for a more pure game, or do you think that, you know, because, it, you know, if you hit a 17-yard shot and Kyle's across, it doesn't matter. If it, you know, if it was, you know, screen, deflected, lucky, whatever, it's still, it's going to affect the game in the same way as a really well-designed goal. You know, where you get a shot on the doorstep, but in the MLL, you know, if you're, whether it's, you know, an end of shot clock heave or, you know, a quick transition opportunity where you can see your guy behind, it's like, yeah, you know, here I am, just give it a shot. And there's a lot of value in having a guy like Jesse who can eat those up and send it back the other way. Whereas, you know, if you're a goalie who isn't as well known for stopping 2-pointers, then, you know, maybe you might invite more of those shots.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, Gittleman has that reputation, and yes, he does let in a fair amount, with six on the season, double what Schwartzman is allowed. But I think the perfect example of this is Crowley's goal against, I believe, who was it against? Long Island. I did it. Against the Lizards. Believe or really early in the season, Crowley took a heave as he was like almost falling out of bounds, and it somehow went in past Adams and won the game with like 3 seconds left. I think that's cool. I like that. I think it's the 2-point shot is built up as this way for teams to get back in the game. And if you watch teams play, like who does that? Bad teams do that. I think you know who I'm talking about. Bad teams do that a lot. But the most of the teams that know what they're doing and have set offenses and are calm about their offense don't go for twos, unless you're Chesapeake on man up and you have Kyle Dixon.
Andrew Westervelt, who from time to time gets an opportunity.
Right. But that play is designed, their man up play is designed for Dixon to get a bomb early in the clock and then hopefully either get it in, get it over, or maybe screen and go in. It does not go in a lot, as evidenced by especially this year and his stats. But you know, it's definitely part of their offense and part of how they set up the other team, and they want those defenders to draw up. So when the ball comes back in, you know, maybe they're not as prepared for a guy with a feed from behind the cage. But anyway, I think two-pointers are not – I think they're a little overrated as game changers in that, you know, teams don't – like, I'm sure every team has a two-point play just in case, you know, like a prayer, like a Christian Laettner, you know, long bomb pass from the other end line to turn and shoot kind of play. But I don't think any team really spends a ton of time training on it. You know, I think that it's just an aspect of the MLL that has to be accounted for. And if you don't, then you're going to pay. But at the same time, you can't rely on it either.
Kyle, did we just spend about 30 minutes talking about a game that might be competitive for a quarter? Please tell me we didn't do that.
I don't think so. I hope not. I really hope not. I like Charlotte as a team, except for when they go into third gear. I think they've made some really shrewd moves to get here. Do I think they're just happy to be here? Yeah, I do. But that being said, I still think they have enough talent and enough star power to give Denver a game. And if Denver comes and has a really bad day, like they did against New York, you know, 3 weeks ago now, this could be interesting. But if Denver comes and is ready to handle business, I think it could be bad for a half. Not a quarter, a half. Not three quarters, a half.
All right. Well, and who knows, there could be a freak injury in pregame warm-ups, and it could go the other way.
You don't say that. You don't say that.
Let's talk about the game that probably has a little bit more teeth, and that is two teams that don't like each other. I was talking to a Bayhawk last week down in Ocean City, and the quote was, "We got the matchup we wanted." I can understand that. I mean, if they're referring to we are not playing the Outlaws, I can understand that. If they're saying that we aren't playing the Hounds, well, I don't know. There might be a little bit more.
The Hounds played tough. The Hounds beat them this year.
No, that's true. I understand. Well, the Nationals didn't.
No, they did, but they beat him in overtime, so they're probably more emotionally inclined to want to beat up the Nationals.
Well, so. I think they're more emotionally inclined to want to beat up the Nationals regardless, because, you know, this is I suppose, like, to a degree, you know, kind of one of those, I feel like these two teams don't really like each other that much.
I don't think Chesapeake likes anyone. Come on.
Well, I mean, that's true. That's always going to be true when you get Spolino and Polanco, but, like, you know, if you were going to rate the teams that they didn't like.
Boston won.
Yeah.
Hamilton to New York. Well, they beat the.
No, I would say Denver 3.
We go Denver 3.
Yeah, but
yeah,
I mean,
that was a pretty rough and tumble game. In the past, it's been New York though.
Well, it's primarily been whoever Brian Lantry played for.
That's true.
All right. Well, anyway, it's all a relatively roundabout way of saying that this is going to be a good one. It's probably not, you know, I don't want to go necessarily like area of the field the way we did with the last one. Probably fair to go a little bit more kind of keys to this one. You know, for Chesapeake, the thing that we always see on championship weekend is their roster construction. It's interesting because I think Hamilton is probably the only other team in the league, you know, that is as similarly loose with their roster throughout the course of the season. You know, not necessarily through trades and acquisitions, but more so through we've got these 27 guys, the, you know, 19 or 20 that we're going to dress on game day fluctuates, and you're not going to know. You know, obviously with Chesapeake, there's always that lingering question at the faceoff X that hasn't answered itself to this point this year. But I don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time talking about that. More so, you know, what's interesting to me is, you know, a little bit of the kind of, where is their, you know, where are they? What state are they in heading into this? Because obviously the Nationals can't like the taste that was left in their mouth at the end of the regular season. And, you know, I don't know if Chesapeake's feeling too good about themselves either. I guess that's the first point. If you're speculating what the mood is in both these locker rooms, where do you feel like it's at?
I think in Chesapeake, they're irrationally confident in a way that many other teams in the league are not. I believe that Chesapeake thinks they 100% should have beaten Denver, like 4 weeks ago. I think they absolutely think they should have beaten Denver. They can't believe they lost. They're just ready to get to the championship game. And I think getting Hamilton before they get there is like a bonus for them, like you were saying. But I do think they're kind of looking past them a little bit. I mean, they handled them at the end of June. They handled them. 17-10. It was not pretty. It was not pretty. Hamilton scored 4 goals in the fourth quarter to make that respectable. You know, it was 16-6 at one point. That was not a fun game to watch or chronicle or anything like that. Trust me. I think what they're going to look at in those games are one of the key things that you were talking about before are faceoffs. And, you know, Poppleton played in both of those games for the Nationals. He kind of took over for Delente when they traded Delente to the Nationals, ironically enough. Actually, they traded him to New York, then to the Nationals. Then he went to Chesapeake. Either way, he did not do well. He went for 11 for 28 in the second game. And in the first game, he went 11 for 27. Adam Rand played really well. Both these guys kind of aren't win it to yourself guys. They're not really guys that are threats in the transition when they win the ball, like Eck or Kelly or even Gorenlian. They're not at that level, or that style of facing off. So I think that, you know, what's going to determine who wins that matchup, is the actual wing play. And I think Chesapeake has some of the best wing play in the entire league. So I think, you know, Hamilton could be in trouble there. Hamilton still has the Ginger Emperor, on their sideline, but, you know, I don't know who that other guy is. If it's Roy Lang, on the wing, or if they're just spelling someone else out there they're throwing a Laugazny out.
Halsey, maybe.
What?
Halsey.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess, you know, I think he's gotten a little more O-run, as of late, but, you know, Hamilton's this really interesting mix of guys that work really hard and guys that don't. It's really strange to watch them play sometimes, especially on offense. They'll have guys that just kind of stand by the pipes and wait for the ball to get to them, and they'll make little 5-yard cuts, and then they'll go back to their spot, like obedient dogs, just kind of like, oh, nope, I'm going to wait for it back here. Nope, you got to give it to me here. All right, I'll go out another – I'll do a C cut. Okay, all right, now I'm back. Give me the ball. And I don't think Chesapeake has a lot of guys like that. I think Chesapeake has a lot of guys that need the ball to be successful. And I think that is the big difference.
You know when lazy guys are not lazy? When you have to play two games in two days to win a championship.
Yeah? You think that changes the whole outlook?
I mean, I think that it's a relatively decent reason why they won in, you know, 08, 09, 10 without really kind of looking like they should. Or no, just 08 and 09.
Yeah, 09, because they won the championship then. They weren't really around in 08.
Well, yeah, I know, but they were still the same team for all intents and purposes. All
right, that's fair. So yeah, they won 2 in a row, essentially. Yeah, no, that's a good point. I don't dispute that point. That's an excellent point. I think, you know, some guys maybe aren't as fast. The transformation of the Nationals also has a lot to do with they did bring in guys that hustle a lot. You know, I feel like I disparaged the Laugazny's, earlier when I was talking about guys on the wing, but they do a good job at what they do. They just don't score a lot and don't show up in the stat book, but they play hard. You know, guys like Crowley plays exceptionally hard this year, you know, has played exceptionally hard, probably harder than I've ever seen him play. But the guys I'm talking about are mostly their attack. I think Joe Alder's played really well. He was talking some mess on Twitter before this game, getting heated up, looking at the poll on Inside the Cross. I think he tweeted a screenshot of, you know, Hamilton, people think they have the least, you know, are the least probable champion. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that's probably a case of Charlotte Hounds fans overvoting. But you know, they have a ton of guys that can score, but they also have a ton of guys that need service to score. I think Chesapeake, you know, manufactures goals with their transition with guys like Matt Abbott, just opening up the field, and getting, forcing the other team to make a slide, forcing them to make a mistake, and then dishing. And getting an easy goal. You know, Chesapeake doesn't get a lot of, they get highlight goals, but that's the nature of the players that they have. They have a lot of highlight real players. But I also think, you know, they got – I think Drew Westervelt's, you know, had a, just a great season by being a guy that gets the ball in his spot and shoots and studies the goalie and knows where to put the ball. I think he's really kind of stepped up this year, especially in comparison to last year's in years past, and become a better player for them. I think that's also because, you know, Kimmel and Dixon have had – a fairly dramatic drop off this year compared to last year and the year before. And guys need to step up.
Do you think that's permanent or do you think that's just a 1 year blip?
I think it's weird that the style they play caters to them and they're still not scoring. I do think that's weird. And the funny thing is like Kimmel will pop up and have like four goals in a game and then he'll have zero goals and two assists. I think it's just the nature of their offense, but also like I would be worried about Dixon hitting the target. I think teams have figured out, you know, if you mess with him enough and you hit him enough, he's going to, you know, retaliate and he's, it's going to kind of take him out of his game. And I think, you know, that's gamesmanship. That's part of what you do. I mean, you have two guys that do that for a living on your team in Polanco and Spallina. So don't be surprised when other people do it to you. I think Hamilton, just in terms of the way they're set up with stationary feeders, with guys that look to the inside, you know, guys that spin the ball, guys that can take big shots, you know, they're definitely a threat. But then you got to talk about keepers. You know, this is a matchup with two outstanding keepers with completely opposite play styles, you know?
Yes, I do know that. I didn't know if that was like a place for me to jump in or not. But I mean, I do agree with your point, you know, in general terms. So I guess when it comes down to it, compared to the first matchup where you feel like you have a relatively solid expectation for how each team is going to play, the outcome of this game is much more dependent on how each team plays, which there's a lot more variability to like fair expectations for how both teams are going to play. Is that you kind of feel that way?
Yeah, and I think that emotion decides this game.
Okay, so let's apply that to the goaltending. Would you rather, in a playoff game, have, and, you know, both of these guys have won championships, the stoic, staid goalie or the emotional, uplifting goalie?
I think, you know, this being, you know, it's not a championship game, but I think you always want to go with consistency over flash, in my opinion, especially at the goaltending spot. I think that's huge. That's not to say that Queener is going to have a worse game than Turner. But, you know, they both goalies have been there, but Turner's been there full time. And Turner's been on the bench full time. And I think Queener, last time he was there, he was splitting time when they won in 2009. So if you're used to splitting time and now this is your first year as a full thing, you feel pretty good. You've established yourself as a top goalie. I think it's radically different when you don't have the cover or the guy to do a lot of the work in front of you in this pressure situation. And I think Kip Turner, you know, last year proved everyone wrong. And in 2011, when he won with the Cannons, you know, when he was on the bench and Burke was getting all the accolades, you know, and he just kept his mouth shut and tried to make him better. I think, you know, that speaks volumes. That's a guy you want leading your back line. And he doesn't have to be like Queener is. Queener has a young defense in front of him, you know, and he has, you know, basically a legend of the game playing in front of him in Merrill, in Brody Merrill. So I think it's different. Kip Turner has guys that can fight his battles for him, you know, whereas Queener just goes out and fights the battle no matter what, because I don't think he realizes he's a goalie and he needs to be protected, not the guy that protects other people. And I think that's what I'm talking about when I say emotion. Now, is that a bad thing? Not necessarily, but it could become a bad thing if you keep coming out of cage and keep running your mouth and someone, you know, like you said, like you alluded to earlier, Jeff Snyder running 50 feet and smashing you in the head because he doesn't like the way you looked at him. I mean, if you think anyone on Chesapeake is not going to sacrifice that, like, come on. You know, if Chesapeake could find a way to take him out of the game, I'm sure they would. Because they're ruthless, man. That's a ruthless team. And I think Hamilton is a little more regimented with how they approach you know, the other side of the ball than they are on defense. That doesn't, I'm not saying that they're bad at defense. I think they're one of the better defensive teams, and they have a philosophy of don't let anyone in the cylinder, let people take distance shots, don't let anyone drive from X and get an easy one. Just put guys on the ground if they do that. You know, they have their own Spoleta in Matt Lovejoy. So I think it's very, the style of defense they play is very similar. But obviously the goalies are very different. And if I have to take one, and trust me, four years ago, there's no way I would have said this. I'm taking Kip Turner. That's just me.
It's amazing how far you've come.
Well, it's not me. It's him. I deserve zero credit.
I mean, that's true, but you've also gotten to know him a little bit, so I'd imagine that, you know, kind of understanding his makeup a little bit better, plus the fact that, yes, he has won a championship, influences that comment.
Yeah, I mean, he's got two. He just didn't play in the other one.
Fair. There you go. All right, well, we've hit on a lot of the things that are pertinent to this matchup, germane to this matchup. One of the things that we haven't touched on yet, at least directly, and, you know, we probably were remiss not to discuss the, I suppose, coaching advantage between Mike Serino and Jim Stagnita, but I will say that, you know, it's less of an issue in that game, or at least it would be less of a prognosticatable issue in that game because, you know, neither guy has as much of a track record as either Dave Cottle or Dave Huntley do in the MLL. Two guys that are going to take... Well, here, let me just say this about both of these guys, because it's funny how, I mean, I've gotten, and I'm sure you have as well, gotten to know, you know, both coaches just through the course of this job, and I you know, have a special place for both of them. I like both of them a lot. You know, they kind of remind me, they're similar types of guys, you know, very much casual and matter-of-fact about the way they go about their business is probably the most diplomatic way I could go about putting it. You know, they no, not a lot of nonsense, but a lot of laughs, if that makes any sense. And ultimately, the reason that I kind of point to those two characteristics as being the types of things that I think could, you know, kind of rear themselves in this day is because I think that, you know, both these guys are going to have their teams prepared, but I don't think either of them is going to have their teams overly wound up. And, you know, for a game that's going to rely on emotion, it'll be interesting to see how they handle it throughout the course of the game because I think that both Cottle and Huntley understand that there's not a whole lot that they can do before the game to try to control the emotion, aside from reinforcing how damaging it could potentially be if you allow the emotion to result in being in the penalty box. Probably more true for, well, I would say, you know, you always say this idea that, like, Canadian offenses are so good on man up, but, you know, you already talked about, you know, Chesapeake's very potent man up play, and if memory serves, Hamilton's man up has been a little bit uninspired over the course of the season, if not, you know, at certain points during the season, and I'm remembering that through stats that were shown on game broadcasts. So
yeah, that's not right.
It's not right at all.
No,
have they been excellent?
Hamilton has been up in the league.
Hamilton does.
Yeah.
All right. Well, fine. Then there you go. Both teams can't really afford to get called for penalties, which was the point that I was originally making. All right, but getting back to the question that I have for you, is there a coaching edge that you would give one way or the other? And obviously, if you think there is an edge, back it up with, you know, a coaching argument.
I really feel like, you know, Cottle has the advantage because he's had more time to work with the guys, just in general with his team. I think, you know, Huntley has worked with a number of the guys on his team, but not everyone on his team before. He is a much younger team than Cottle has. And I think that if you look at how the teams have played, they actually mirror their coaches a lot. And Cottle during games is kind of very different than he is in person. He's there is a lot of yelling. Not all of it is angry. Some of it is just, I'm yelling so you can hear me. And I don't think, Huntley really yells at all. I feel like Huntley could, like, be cutting down a tree with a chainsaw, cut his hand off, and be like, hey, 911, cut my hand off, come get me. You know, like, he's just very so calm and so collected. Every time I've spoken with him, even if I ask him a question that I know is going to set him off, he's just like, well, you know, I don't think I can answer that. You know, he's much more even-keeled, I think, than Cottle is. But that's not an advantage or a disadvantage because, I feel like Cottle has had more time with his guys. They know what to expect from him in return, and I think that goes a very long way. So if I'm going to have, you know, you're going to make me pick an advantage, I'm going to go with Kyle just on the basis of time with his players, not on any other tactical way. Because, I mean, look what Huntley did with his team. No, I mean, this team was a joke going into this season. They were being laughed at. They were like, oh, well, we're just going to mine junior A, junior B teams and, you know, some senior A guys that don't want to play and just throw them in for the first couple games when everyone else is, you know, playing pro box and in the NLL. And then, you know, he busts out and they win three in a row without their NLL guys. And I think that says a lot. I think it says a lot for the other teams being unprepared and a lot for people like me who were, you know, discounting his impact, which, you know, sorry, I guess. But it was good for a couple laughs while it lasted. And I think that that's something that can't be ignored. But I mean, like I said, if you're making me pick, I'm going to pick Cottle because he's had more time. And the players know what to expect of him and know the game plan and, you know how to win championships. So I think that goes a long way.
Well, I think we've thoroughly covered Saturday. We're not going to be doing a podcast between Saturday and Sunday because I'm going to be in Las Vegas for my bachelor party and you're going to be in Philadelphia covering the games. Maybe you can do one with Kinnear. That being said,
Matt's not going to be there until Sunday.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, yeah, you're probably not going to. This is probably the last podcast folks are going to get about the ML championship
game. Babo and Vok.
Whatever. Dude, do your thing. Whatever. Yeah. Point being, let's talk a little bit about Sunday without knowing who's going to be there. I'm not going to ask you to predict who you think is going to win on Saturday to make the conversation easier because I think that's dumb. But I am curious as to what, you know, if any of these four teams advance, which of them do you like on Sunday and why?
You know,
the best way to answer this question is just come with a random reason that somebody either has like really good stamina or really good emotion or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if there was like a similar scenario that unfolds that would be equivalent to the Rhode Island Rocket getting suspended on Saturday of the 2011 championship weekend and scoring 5 goals on Sunday, you know, that would be a good answer to this question.
Right. I think Denver has the best chance because Denver has the most to prove. They really do. I know that sounds kind of ridiculous of an undefeated team. They have so much to prove, but they do. You know, I've been discounting the argument of this team is rough. This team, you know, this team hasn't won in the postseason ever, like gets to the championship game and chokes. Like this team's a bunch of chokers. And I've kind of been playing against that the whole time. But at the same time, people keep saying it because it's historically true. I don't necessarily think it's historically, you know, that it is presently true. But historically, it's true. This is a team that has choked on Sunday of championship weekend. But I think that the people that know that the best are the people that want to win the most. And that's the people that are on the Outlaws. You know, I don't think, you know, we wrote up these little picks for championship for IL that's going to go up, I believe, Friday, kind of like our version of the picks of the game. And, you know, I put Denver out there as my pick just because it has to be. Like, this is either a team that's going to prove everyone wrong and have the best story as the best team in the history of the MLL, or they're going to have unrepairable heartbreak. Now, most people would assume that I am rooting for unrepairable heartbreak because I'm a negative Nancy or whatever. Not the case. I would love for this team to prove everyone wrong. And in many ways, not the most important ways, but in many ways, I think that Denver is sort of an underdog here. If that makes any sense at all. It doesn't. I know it doesn't. But think about all the pressure that they have to win. Think about that, because it's there. They can tell you it's not there, but they're lying. They've won every individual award that's been announced so far except for Offensive Player of the Year, and they probably had a guy that should have won that. And I doubt any of them care. They just want to win the big one. And if they don't, it's going to be so devastating to them that it's really going to wreck this team, in my opinion.
What's so interesting to me is that I think back to walking into the locker room after they lost during the Hurricane Irene game 2 years ago, and there was palpable disappointment, palpable anger at the loss. However, that team has turned over so much since then. You know, the guys that stand out in my memory as being, like, you know, exceptionally upset. So whether, you know, Langtree obviously would be one, and, you know, it was pretty notable because he was caught on camera at the end of the game being that upset. But, you know, Drew Westervelt, Max Siebold, Jarrett Park, I remember, you know, kind of specifically, I don't know, a couple other guys that stand out as well. You know, with the exception of Jesse and Mundy and, you know, obviously a couple of guys like Zink, who to me is, you know, more stoic than Kip Turner to the point where I don't know if I've ever really kind of seen him emote. This isn't a team that to me is carrying the cross of past failures. Last year seems like a fluke to me. I don't know that I see it the same way. That being said, the point that you make about having the most to prove, having an emotional advantage on this week, and is such an interesting thing to consider, because I remember writing a story, I believe it was after, I can't remember, I think it was after the 2009 MLL Championship, and it was the first one that I saw in person. And I remember, like, walking away with it, being so impressed with the amount of emotion that all the teams played with. And to me, like I made the point earlier, you can kind of make everything equal as far as everybody putting in maximum effort, you know, when you play two games in 2 days. But if there is, which generally means that no team is going to have an emotional advantage, and if you can find an emotional advantage in some specific way, like the way you just talked about with the Outlaws, then it makes sense to me that that could be a deciding factor.
Right. Yeah, and that's kind of why I'm picking them. I feel like that's definitely there, and it's something that can't be ignored. You know, conversely, who has, you know, who, in your opinion, who else has more to lose? You know, and like, obviously no one wants to lose, but is Chesapeake the team that has the most to lose? Is it Hamilton? Is it Charlotte? I feel like Hamilton and Charlotte don't have a ton to lose and have proven a lot by getting here. Especially this season, given what they did last season. And Charlotte, especially being at their second, you know, year in the league. I feel like the other team that has a lot to prove, and it, not only to themselves, but, you know, to the league and, you know, they've lost more games than they should have. I mean, they lost like 3 overtime games. So what are you going to do about that? Win them, I guess. But do you think that Chesapeake is also kind of in a similar spot where, like, if they lose, it's going to kind of be a really big disappointment?
No, I don't. Because I think that they've – well, here, I guess, you know, and you're the pessimist, I'm the optimist. I'm looking at it from the perspective of they can lose being a dynasty. If they win 3 and 4 years, that's a dynasty. I mean, that's Alabama football. You know what I mean? But I don't know how many people are thinking about – the Bayhawks is going for a dynasty because the Outlaws are such a heavy favorite. And it is interesting to consider what the Outlaws have to lose by losing. However, I also think that because they have this reputation of choking, if they were to win, it's almost like it would be a surprise, right? You already talked about it as from the prospect of them being an underdog. I guess I'm just kind of talking out myself how much I agree with you. But no, I mean, if Chesapeake loses, I bet they'll be angry, but I don't know how disappointed they'll be. Does that make sense? And do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think a ton of them will be disappointed. I think people are like, you know, not, you know, to go back to another analogy, they're kind of looking at Denver as the UMass, circa what, 2012, losing to Colgate in the first round, kind of thing,
where because they were undefeated.
Yeah, they're undefeated.
But I don't think the fact that they're undefeated matters nearly as much this year as the fact that they've made it to the playoffs every year and they haven't won a championship. And the fact that they were, you know, in a really good position to win last year and they didn't.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. And I think their comeback in the semifinal last year is sometimes forgotten when you talk about, you know, the Bayhawks, quote-unquote, dominance of them the next day. You know, that's definitely a big part of how – I think there's a lot of, like, using words like dynasty and you know, kind of like legendary, kind of like this, like, tinge to it, which I think actually can't be underplayed, because I think it's really cool that we're talking about teams in the MLL as dynasties. Like, what is the other dynasty? It's the Barrage, right? That's the only other one.
Well, I don't know. I mean, what if, okay, if the Nationals win this year and you do properly include the Rattlers of 08, like, I mean, this, I understand that, you know, you can't have the trough years that they had the previous two and still be considered a dynasty, but it is a pretty amazing testament to Dave Hundley's legacy.
Oh, yeah, I think that's definitely what, I mean, I thought you were going the other way with that, but yeah, that's definitely what I would focus on if we were going to talk about it, and they won. I mean, he definitely cements his legacy as one of the best MLL coaches basically of all time. But
well,
I mean,
probably the best MLL coach of all time. I mean, well, Tony Resch is in that conversation as well, and obviously the fact that, was he on the staff for the 2010 Bayhawks? I don't think he was.
Not for 2010, but he was.
But he was last year, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I think, I mean, he's kind of the guy, but not the guy that people remember because the Barrage are like this forgotten garbage team that were really awesome and everyone forgot about because they no longer exist. I don't know. I think, you know, Bayhawks winning, you're definitely right. Jeff brings in the dynasty. You know, Denver winning, you know, is another team with, you know, getting a monkey off their back. A la Boston 2011.
You know what? I don't know if this is contradicting myself. However, if they win, I bet this storyline is less they got the monkey off their back and more perfect season. It's going to change in 2 days' time. Like, the reason that they have pressure is different from the way they'll be remembered if they win. That's my opinion, and I think that it's very, very convoluted.
No, I think that's a tough thing to tackle. I mean, that's more of a media question than a question. That's kind of the thing that we grapple with. I don't think like the common fan even really cares. They're just happy their team wins the championship.
Oh, no doubt. But, you know, Miami Dolphins fans love when they do the stupid champagne popping when the last team loses in the NFL. But like if the Miami Dolphins, because they won in 72, right? If they had lost in the championship game in 70 and 71, which maybe they did, like, they wouldn't be remembered as the team that got the monkey off their back. They would still be remembered as this team that had the perfect season. And I think that that's why I'm saying this about the Outlaws.
Yeah, there's no disputing that. And I think that's definitely part of it. I think the only person that would be monkey off their back is probably me. Cause I would, that's what I would focus on. Cause again, I'm the negative Nancy and I want to rub it in. That, hey, remember all those times you lost? Yeah, I was there. Yeah. Yeah. Good way to win this one though. Good job. There you go, buddy. Good job. That would be me, because that's who I am. But I think you're definitely right in that the most people remember them as the perfect season. And I think, you know, the pressure's there for that. The pressure's there to win. But I think, you know, like I said, there really is, like, a lot riding for the Outlaws. And I think you have to look at, you know, how they've won those 14 games. You know, how they've matched up, how they've beaten every team that's in the playoffs against them. How soundly have they whooped them? How soundly have they whooped Charlotte, Hamilton, and Chesapeake? That's six games that are going to tell you what to expect. And if you put that again with what they've done recently going into the playoffs, I think you have a really good idea of what's going to happen.
Well, Kyle Devitt, we spent a lot of time talking about things that we really don't know what are going to happen and legacies that we don't know whether or not they're going to be built. And the next time we'll talk, we'll have answers. I'm really pleased with this show, given how little preparation I did for it. I thought it turned out well, and I owe a lot of that to you. So, bravo.
Thanks. I only spent like 5 hours on the call. I'm going to spend 5 hours on the next one. It's all good.
All right, we'll have fun.
Yep, got to be the best. See you at championship weekend. Well, not you, but everyone else.
The listeners.
I'll see you there. Buy tickets.
All right, until next time.
Inside the Cross Podcast.